It's just past 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Teekert. Kat Brooks is on vacation this week and next week, taking a well-deserved break. I'm joined in studio, as we are most Mondays at this time, by Mitch Jeserich.
Have you been following Kat on social media?
Occasionally.
It's pretty amazing.
Japan looks pretty overwhelming.
Oh my goodness, Tokyo.
Yeah, at night.
Wow. I feel like we can learn some things from Tokyo. And this is, we're remodeling Oakland now. I was amazed.
You want more neon?
Yeah. and everything else. I mean, it was almost like an acid trip without acid.
Mm.
Yeah. I'm just saying, planners of Oakland may want to look into all that.
Yeah, you live in Oakland, don't you?
Yes.
You want that outside your front door?
I mean, now I have big cranes outside my windows, so, you know, like a bunch of them. So why not embrace it?
Just
embrace
lean in.
It. Just go. I'm done opposing it all. Bring it on. Go as far as you possibly can. Just,
you're going to stop telling the kids to get off your lawn.
Yep.
Mitch Jeserich, let's start in Washington, D.C. So after our work weekend on Thursday, news broke that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House spokesperson, is quitting. She'll be gone within a month. Any reflections on the passage of someone who was quite good at brazenly lying to the press?
I mean, she was really good at that job for the way Donald Trump wanted it. I think she was perhaps the most significant press secretary. Now, I'm not saying good press secretary in the sense of admirable, but most significant press secretary, at least since Ari Fleischer, but I think with George W. Bush, but I think I would argue even more so and even more significant than Ari Fleischer. First, she just played the character. You know, this in a way, you know that Donald Trump sees all of this as a TV show. And he sort of proved that if you watch George Stephanopoulos's 30 hours with Donald Trump last night on ABC, where he spent 30 hours with Donald Trump. And he's interviewing Donald Trump. And in the middle of one of Donald Trump's questions, his chief of staff coughs in the background. And Donald Trump just stops the interview and says, "Let's do all that again. I don't like that he coughed in the middle of my answer," right? So, I mean, he is a TV guy. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders was just the press secretary we loved to hate. It was very theatrical. You could just see the disdain that she had in her face for the reporters when they used to have the press daily briefings. And that's it's important, too, because for as long as I have been covering Washington politics, there was always a daily briefing that was done, usually by the top press secretary, sometimes by administration officials or a deputy secretary of the press office, but usually the press secretary. And they were fraught with problems. Oftentimes, you never got the full truth. And there was always a saying that the worst place to cover the White House is inside the White House, mm-hmm. because it's so tightly controlled. In there, many of the White House correspondents have their own little cubicle within the White House. They have a press room where people hang out. You also have that in the Supreme Court. You have it in the Capitol, as I know firsthand. But in the White House, it is so, unlike, say, Congress, in the White House, it is so tightly controlled that, again, the word is it's the worst place to actually cover the White House. But still, the daily press briefings were important because you could at least get the official response, the official position of the White House through those daily briefings. And what they became, especially with the Trump administration, was a daily back and forward of, no, you're not telling the truth, or this is not right, and blah, 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 blah. And so Sarah Huckabee Sanders, more than 3 months ago, stopped giving them. We haven't had one in over 3 months. And I do think that's significant. I do think that's a significant step of what happens between the relationship between a White House and the press, which is an important relationship. It's usually, it can be adversarial. It can be difficult. They can't dislike each other, whatever it is. But you would think for the role, for democracy's sake, for the way the political system works, it's important to have that kind of relationship, even with all the problems that it did have. And not to have it anymore, what does it mean for the next press secretary that is coming in? Are they going to try to continue them? Is this the new norm? And then even what happens, you know, as we've talked about many times, what happens after the Trump presidency is over and you get a new president? How do they approach these kind of things and openness with the press? So I think it's significant. Saturday Night Live. I mean, Sean Spicer was pretty good too. And again, when I say good, I mean very interesting in the TV theatrical aspect of it. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders was something else. And word has it, you know, her father, Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, it's believed that Sarah Huckabee Sanders may be running for governor in 2020. So that might be part of her move. She's very young. She's only 36.
Wow.
I did not realize that.
Yeah. It's an important question, which of those norms kind of reset. I mean, in a way, the White House press pool is kind of antiquated. I mean, now that the president kind of has a direct line to the public through Twitter, right, and through all the outlets obsessively covering everything he tweets, the only thing the press corps gives you, having the press corps assembled in the White House at all times, is like accountability questions. What president wants that?
No president really wants it. Barack Obama certainly didn't want it. No one really wanted it. But it's been foundational, right? I mean, the press has been inside the White House as a daily event, and even is able to really create their own offices with inside, at least, you know, the big correspondents for the publications like New York Times, Washington Post, the broadcasters, ABC, CNN, they all have White House correspondents. That's where they work, mm-hmm. right? That's where their office is. That's where they go every day. And I used to do that at the Capitol. On Capitol Hill, which is actually much freer. Press pass in Capitol Hill gets you almost everywhere, mm-hmm. More so than even aides can get to. But in the White House, you're very much confined to this small roped area. And again, but it is about access, right? That's why you want to be in there, because not only in that White House do you have the press secretary, you also have the chief of staff, you have officials constantly coming and going. And, you know, it was fraught with problems before. The press briefings were never a place for a bastion of truth. But I think what has changed between before Trump and now is, and I'm not trying to say previous press secretaries always told the truth, because they did not, but Sarah Huckabee Sanders will just say a straight out lie, in which everyone in the room knows is a lie.
As opposed to artfully deploying weasel words.
Yeah.
That would give you plausible deniability later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's been interesting to watch and see what happens after.
Mitch Jesrich, I want to talk a little bit about developments on the international affairs front, specifically what appears to be the march to war by the Trump administration with Iran. Our government's been escalating tensions there for quite some time. Then news breaks late last week that two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman have been attacked. The Trump administration lays the blame at the feet of Iran. And I guess the latest development in the tit for tat this morning is Iran is now saying it's resumed enriching uranium and expects within 10 days to be in violation of the 2015 nuclear weapons development agreement to avoid nuclear weapons development in Iran that the Obama administration brokered and the Trump administration pulled out of.
Yeah, and Iran has previously said that it would start to pull back on the agreements of that nuclear agreement that was struck with the Obama administration, even while Europe has remained as in that agreement, in part because the sanctions are back, at least from the United States, and you know, reportedly they've been devastating to Iran. And so Iran has said I think they said like over a time period, maybe every 30 days or so, that the United States stays out of this agreement, we will start to not fully pull out, but we will start to pull back from it. And I think this is one of those indications of that happening. Yeah, you know, I don't know, and I have no way of telling for sure what has happened in the Gulf of Oman. It is hard to believe that Iran would purposely be trying to pick a fight, a military escalation with the United States. But again, I'm not there. I think what's happening, Brian, which corresponds with all of this, is what's happening actually back in Washington, D.C. between the White House and Congress. Mm. And in particular, the White House going around Congress and providing and selling $8 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Now, previously, Congress passed a resolution saying that that we would no longer support Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen. And Donald Trump vetoed that resolution. But Congress was able to pass it through the Republican-controlled Senate and the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives.
Exercise of the War Powers Act since its inception.
That's right. Exactly. And so, and all funding originates from Congress, as per se, the Constitution, right at the beginning. So Congress never approved $8 billion worth of sales to Saudi Arabia. However, in the what's called the Arms Export Control Act, there is an exception for an emergency. And Donald Trump went ahead, and the Trump president, White House, went ahead and invoked that emergency to be able to sell, anyways, $8 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia. And their justification for that, their emergency, is because this isn't the first time the United States has claimed Iran has interfered or even attacked ships, oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. And so that's their justification. And they're looking at this situation. That's how they're deciding. That's how they're claiming this is the emergency. We need to send these weapons to Saudi Arabia because, of course, Saudi Arabia is the counterforce to Iran in the region. However, that doesn't solve the problem in Washington, D.C., because Congress was not very pleased by this sale of $8 billion to Saudi Arabia. And it appears as there are now enough votes in the Senate that would attempt to undo the sale. They have more than 50 votes, and it can't be filibustered because of the rules over this thing. Mm-hmm. It cannot be filibustered. And they say now, the people who count votes, that they have at least 51 votes, and they'll probably have more than that. Just not everyone has claimed so far how they're going to vote. And it could be taken up this week. And then the House of Representatives will take it up, and very, very likely the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives will pass it too. However, it's still a piece of legislation, and it would still need the president's signature, which he's obviously not going to sign. And then it comes back to Congress, and just like the resolution to end support Saudi Arabia for the war in Yemen, very unlikely that they can actually get the 2/3 necessary to override this veto.
Those votes could start happening as early as this week.
Yeah, in the Senate happen this week. Yeah, and it's interesting. And you characterized it as the White House or the Trump's march to war with Iran. And if that were to occur, usually, and I'm not convinced it is, but I do think it's alarming, and we should be concerned about it. But if it did, this would be unique, because usually when the United States goes to war, it has large backing by both parties in Congress. There'll be a few who mm-hmm. are against it, but usually it has large backing, just like it did in 2003 in the invasion of Iraq. This probably not so. Democrats are up to this point blaming Donald Trump for the situation with Iran, for mm-hmm. pulling out of the nuclear agreement that Barack Obama struck with the country. And so that would be, you know, in an era of very divisive politics, that would be just another element or part of the equation.
That's interesting. I had, until you said that, I had kind of assumed that there would be a rally around the flag effect, as we've seen in the opening months of like every U.S. war I can imagine. I didn't realize that that relied on elite consensus in the realm of politics. In other words, like, the opposition party rallies around the flag before the public does. It would be very interesting to see an administration-led drive to war with the party out of power clamoring in opposition.
And in power in the House of Representatives.
Right.
And, you know, we always talk about the one power that the Democrats have in the House of Representatives is impeachment for, and really they were talking about the Mueller report and everything, but it can actually include this aspect, but in many other aspects, the House of Representatives has the power of the purse. It can say, just like it did and threatened to do in the Vietnam War, we're not going to fund this war anymore, mm-hmm. right? So it's not completely out of power. It controls the House of Representatives, where it has actually a tremendous amount of power, especially where the money goes. Now, who knows? If a conflict were to break out, maybe they change course. Maybe they get worried. You know, war does funny things to people. But up to this point, including Nancy Pelosi, the majority leader in the House, they've been very critical towards Donald Trump for pulling out of that agreement and kind of putting the onus on that for the current tensions. Hmm.
So Mitch Jeserich, this morning is a Supreme Court decision issuing morning. I've had I've been speaking to you one eyeball on the live blog over at SCOTUS blog, and none of the cases we've been watching closely have been disposed of yet, although some still may be this morning. But I did want to catch up on a kind of a late breaking development last week and something we've been watching closely, which is litigation over whether or not the Department of Commerce can add a question to the 2020 census that asks about citizenship status. Now, this has been immensely controversial because the department's own analysis indicates about 6.5 million people fewer would kind of declare their existence on the census, and that would be disproportionately Hispanics and specifically undocumented immigrants were supposed to be counted as part of the census. And that would have all manner of downstream impacts from how much Department of Education funding goes to which region of the country to how many congressional seats each state gets to also how many electoral votes each state gets in upcoming presidential elections. And the kind of worst gloom and doom scenario out of this is it's kind of a consolidation of power by the Trump administration, kind of engineering the apparatus of democracy, because the census is used to draw congressional maps, engineering the apparatus of democracy to ensure a largely white Republican minority, increasingly out of touch with an increasingly diverse, progressive American public, is able to continue and perpetuate a regime of minority rule. The addition of that question was just like buried in lawsuits, and a grand total of 3 federal judges now have told the Commerce Department to cut it out. One largely basing his argument on the Administrative Procedures Act. You know, what the process they went through to get there, the agency's decision was not grounded in the analysis by its staff. It appears arbitrary and capricious. Another one apparently on a notice window that is built into some law governing the census that you have to propose new questions to Congress at least 3 years before the census, which obviously did not happen in this case. And the third one on the enumeration clause in the Constitution, which says the census shall count all persons in the United States. And it is very clear through context that persons does not refer strictly or exclusively to citizens. The enumeration clause was written at a time when many non-citizens would have to be counted in the census.
And citizenship wasn't even clearly defined at that point.
And citizenship was not even clearly defined. So there was this curveball that got thrown in when a Republican political consultant, gerrymandering consultant, Thomas Hoefler, died. His estranged daughter comes into possession of his estate, digs up hard drives and thumb drives with his records and shares their contents with the people who are suing to get the census question kicked out in the courts. And they include correspondence that makes it clear that he was the engineer of the argument, the rationale for including the citizenship question, which the Department of Commerce's rationale has been, we need to add this in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Other parts of his record indicate that he advocated for adding a citizenship question because, in his words, it would increase the representation and power of Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. That's almost a direct quote. I don't have the quote in front of me. So there's been the scuffle in the court around whether these new documents, which came up after trial, but before the appeal is disposed of at the Supreme Court, you know, whether they get admitted as evidence, whether this documentation that flatly contradicts the government's stated rationale about why it's doing what it's doing, become part of the court's consideration at all. So the latest move by the attorneys trying to get this question kicked off the census was on Friday to ask the Supreme Court to back off and send it back to a lower court before disposing of it to resolve these issues of facts at the trial level. And I can't remember the last time attorneys who had a case pending in front of the Supreme Court said, hey, don't decide now. Kick it back down the food chain.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it makes me wonder, and I don't have the answer as to if the Supreme Court is able to bring in new evidence after they get the case. Mm. Or is it just reviewing what has already been litigated?
So the facts of a case are established at the trial court level, and then matters of interpretation and law are supposed to be decided at the appeals and Supreme Court level. The issue here was they had gone to the trial judge and basically tried to get him, as I understand it, to admit this evidence and kick it up the food chain to the Supreme Court for their consideration. The judge, Obama judge, declined to. This is, I believe, in the New York case where it was decided fairly narrowly on grounds of the Administrative Procedures Act and largely on things that were a matter of public record. So we'll see.
So we're going to know within the next 2 weeks, by the end of next week.
Well, we could find out today. The Supreme Court is still reading decisions from the bench. The only two dates they have scheduled for further decisions are the next 2 Mondays, although they could add one to their calendar.
They can add days to the calendar, yeah. I mean, it seems like today would be a little early. Who knows? But it would be a little early if this was just filed on Friday.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Well, they could hold off on issuing a decision today because they're considering the thing that was filed on Friday. In any case, Mitch Jesrich, always good to see you, even when Kat's not here.
Well, thank you, Brian. ditto.
Mitch Jesrich, you can catch him Mondays through Thursdays at 10 a.m. on KPFA on Letters in Politics. This program's Up Front. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiekert. When we come back, an exploration of America's radical social experiments in the suburbs.